Hello, and welcome to Wiki Politiki, a show designed to bring right and left front and center, to turn the funk into function, and leave the junk at the junction. At a time when so much political discourse is heat without light, Wiki Politiki shines the light of love and truth on the darkened corridors of power, and then brings leading solutionaries into conversation to light the way forward together. Your host is Steve Behrman, author, comedian, and political and spiritual uncommentator. You might know Steve as his cosmic comic alter ego, Swami Beyondananda, or as the author of a more serious book with cellular biologist Bruce Lipton, Spontaneous Evolution. If you recognize that crisis precipitates evolution, and judging by the current crises, the chances of precipitation are 100%, this show is for you. Welcome to the Evolutionary Upwising. Now, here is your host, Steve Behrman.
Well, hello and welcome to Wiki Politiki Conversations for Co-Creation, where we shed light on the darkened corridors of power and we shine light ahead of us to where evolution is leading. Now, the purpose of Wiki Politiki is to bring left and right front and center to face the music and dance together, to address problems instead of defending positions. You know, last week on Wiki, we interviewed Tarek Mounib about his documentary, Free Trip to Egypt. And if you are fortunate enough to see that movie on June 12th at one of the special showings at 500 theaters around the country, and you stayed for the panel discussion broadcast from Washington, D.C., then you're already familiar with this week's guest, Rabbi Rami Shapiro. Now, as more and more of us are coming to understand, human survival and thrival are dependent on human evolution. Evolution from children of God to adults of good. And we seem to be stuck collectively in that awkward stage called addled essence, where our essence has been addled by obsolete and obsoletal beliefs. As Swami says, it's a dogma-eat-dogma world out there. And in case you haven't noticed, there's a pitched battle going on between two dueling paradigms, traditional religion and scientific materialism, each of which hold part of the story, neither of which have the whole picture. As Bruce Lipton has pointed out, this modern religion called science actually uses words like dogma and heresy to enforce a set of beliefs, not unlike religion. And while science is supposedly a system for carefully assessing evidence and determining fact, I have to say I've met fundamentalist scientific materialists as fervent as their religious counterparts. Unfortunately, while these two incomplete narratives are duking it out, we've lost the sane and sacred coherence of spiritual and material acting together in accord. Well, this week's guest on Wiki, Rabbi Rami Shapiro, has dedicated his work and life to, in his words, quote, working for the spiritual liberation of humankind by freeing religion from the parochial and the political, the tribal and the xenophobic, the one-dimensional and literal, to reclaim the perennial wisdom at the heart of humanity's sacred myths, stories, rituals, and symbols. That is so well said. A Jewish practitioner of perennial wisdom, Rabbi Rami is an award-winning author of over 36 books on religion and spirituality. He received his rabbinical ordination from the Hebrew Union College, Jewish Institute of Religion, and holds a PhD in religion from Union Graduate School. He's a rabbinic chaplain. He was a chaplain with the Air Force for 3 years, a congregational rabbi for 20 years, and a professional professor of religious studies for 10 years, and he currently co-directs the One River Foundation. He also considers himself a holy rascal, which he defines as, quote, spiritual culture jammers who playfully pull back the curtain on the great and terrible wizards of parochial piety and shallow spirituality to free religion from hucksterism and pious pabulum. I love it. Hi, Rabbi Rami. Welcome.
Thanks, Steve. It's a pleasure to be here.
Okay, well, let's start at the beginning. How do you define perennial wisdom? What is perennial wisdom?
The way I use the term, perennial wisdom speaks to the four key elements or teachings at the heart of all mysticism, regardless of the culture or religion in which it arises. And the four points very simply are the first one is everything in the universe or the universe itself is a manifesting of a singular reality. So you can call it God or Brahman or reality or nature or mother, whatever you want to call it. There's just this singular reality that manifests in myriad diverse ways. So that's point one. Point two is that human beings have the innate capacity to realize they are part of this greater unity. And number three, when you do that, when you realize that we are all manifestings of this singular reality, there it releases an ethic of compassion and justice in you. It's not a command from the outside. It's a, I don't know, compulsion is the wrong word, but it's this sense of you have to be compassionate, you have to be just, not as a rule, but you just can't help yourself. When I realize you and I are, you know, brothers in this case, of a singular reality, then I have to treat you with love, respect, dignity, et cetera. And then the fourth point is knowing that we're part of this singular reality and living out the ethic that it implies is the highest thing that people can do.
Well, you know, it's extraordinarily simple and straightforward. And as Swami has said, I am proposing a sane world. I must be crazy. Because if we look around us, we've seen, the divisiveness and all of these Tower of Babel, Tower of Babylon, all around us. And yet what you say is so resonant. And as you say, it's a common factor in every one of these, every one of religious or ethical principles. Do you see that we're making any progress in coming to this common realization?
No.
In a word, no.
In a word, no. You know, it's something that you can talk about openly. I mean, I go around the world talking about this stuff. And when I'm in a community, whether it's a religious community or a spiritual community or a secular community, and you lay out the four principles of perennial wisdom, most people nod in agreement. They go, oh, yeah, I get that. Not just intellectually, but I think there's truth to that. But when you have to translate the philosophy into action, then people don't want to do the work. Because there's two parts of the work. I mean, one is the inner work, the contemplative part of it, where you really have to, whatever the system is that you choose, whatever the contemplative or meditative system is you choose, you have to be able to drop or have dropped on your behalf the narratives that define you. And that's, in a sense, step one, the prerequisite to awakening to the unity and the ethic that comes with it. So that right away makes it very difficult. It's not that the practices are hard, it's that people just don't want to put that kind of energy into what looks like doing nothing. And recently, you know, I've been doing this series of workshops called Be a Blessing. It's from the book of Genesis, chapter 12, verse 3, where Abraham and Sarah, who I take in as stand-ins for, you know, humanity, are challenged to be a blessing to all the families of the earth, all of them, human and otherwise. And I've got this workshop that I do, and it can be done in a day. It's a weekend. It's fun. It explores what does it mean to be a blessing? How can I be a blessing in different situations that I find myself in? And it ends with people, we give away buttons that say, be a blessing as a reminder, this is my task. So if you don't get it from the contemplative side, you know, like you say in 12 step, you know, fake it till you make it kind of thing. So you guess, all right, let me work the blessing side as best I can. And then I have people pushing back saying, oh, no, that's too – I had one guy say, it was a woman, she said to me, I don't want to be a blessing. Okay, that's good. Just, as long as you're not armed, I'll live with that. But I've had people turn the buttons back in and say, no, you know, I'm not going to give these out. It's too intimidating. So it's a real struggle.
You know, it's really interesting. I think we are at a time right now where the one tool that we have is cognitive dissonance. Nori Huddle, who wrote the book Butterfly, back in the 80s, she was a peace activist, had access to people in Ronald Reagan's cabinet and sub-cabinet members, and she was going around and presenting her peace platform, and this one guy simply yelled and screamed at her and told her to get out of here, you're crazy. She screamed, and she left, and she went, well, you win some and you lose some. And about 2 years later, she gets a call from this guy. He says, that conversation changed my life. And wow. Because of the conflict that it put him in, the internal conflict it put him in, and the fact that he was willing to engage with that conflict, he changed his life, he changed his career, and he called her to thank her. But the initial response was resistance, because I don't think we want to be vulnerable. I think we feel very endangered, and having a button called Be a Blessing, or giving out a button called Be a Blessing, is confrontative to our own protective armor, don't you think? Maybe that's what it is.
Yeah. I think people are afraid. I mean, almost define ourselves by circling the wagons around one, you know, issue or another. So yeah, it is. It's very difficult. You know, I live in the South. People are always saying to one another, you know, have a blessed day, God bless you. I have a friend who's my partner in this giving out the be a blessing button movement, and he carries them with him. And when people say at the grocery store, you know, have a blessed day, his comeback is not just, you know, you too, but, you know, may you be a blessing to all the families of the earth. And then he offers them a button. And so far, it's been going on for months. So far, the only reaction he gets is, what? No, I don't want any of that.
Well, you know, clearly he's pushing buttons, he's pushing buttons.
Yes, exactly.
The more he pushes those buttons, the more he pushes buttons. I want to go back so we can go forward here. Tell us a little bit about your own background. What inspired you to become a rabbi? And then how did you upgrade from the religion you learned as a child to embracing this perennial wisdom?
I grew up in a modern Orthodox home, so we were very observant, but not really engaged theologically. It's not so unusual in Judaism, but we did what Jews were supposed to do, according to my dad. And I never rebelled against that. I mean, I just did that. But theologically, it didn't speak to me. I was looking for something more than adherence to cultural norms. And in my junior year of high school, two teachers went to India during the summer, came back and taught a course called Asian Civilization. And I was hooked on Buddhism and Hinduism. I thought, wow, this is about meditation. This is about experience. So I sort of set as my life goal to become a professor of Buddhist studies. And I was very drawn to Zen, and I studied Zen, you know, I would say seriously, but clearly not. You know, I did the best I could at the time, and I did it for 10 years. And at one point during a session, one of these intense meditation retreats, the Roshi came up to me, and he heard through the grapevine that I was planning to go to graduate school for an advanced degree in Buddhist studies, and he thought that was a complete waste of time. And in a very intimidating way, made no bones about it. And he said, if you really want to understand Buddhism, then you move to the monastery and you just sit. And going to the university is a mistake. And he literally kept moving closer and closer and backed me against a wall. And what happened was, he said, you know, move to the monastery. And I blurted out, I I can't do that, Roshi. I'm going to become a rabbi. And now that was news to me. I was going to be a PhD professor of Buddhism, but that was my, I didn't think it through. It wasn't like a strategy. It just came out. That's how I was going to get out of this situation. And he says he was Japanese, and he said in a heavy Japanese accent, you know, I'm going to imitate it, hopefully not in a way that is offensive, but he said, "Oh, good, be rabbi, be Zen rabbi." I said, "Okay, I will do that. I'll be a Zen rabbi, whatever the hell that is." Just, you know, that's what I'm going to do. But he was right about grad school. I lasted less than a day in Buddhist studies. It was so boring, so not what I was looking for. But there was a professor of Jewish studies on the faculty who had no students working with him for advanced degrees. And he was very happy to find a Jew who wanted to study Judaism, which is what I went to as my fallback after Buddhism failed me, or I failed it. And so that could put me on the path to you know, through rabbinical school and getting ordained.
It's very interesting how that happened. In a way, the fact that you blurted that out, that could have been the future speaking to you in some regard. So that was your graduate program. And then did you go into the Air Force after that, or you had some other journey?
Yeah, no, I was the Air Force was very short on Jewish clergy in the chaplaincy, and so they had a special program you could actually sign up even before you were completely finished with rabbinical school. So I volunteered and did the 3 years of the Air Force. I really enjoyed the Air Force because you were doing good work. You could tell. I mean, the ideal of the chaplaincy in my mind was you're dealing with these young people. Of course, they were only maybe 10 years younger than I was, but you're dealing with these people who are suddenly taken out of their comfort zone and placed in this radically different environment, faced with all kinds of challenges. And the chaplains were there to help them in any way they needed help. So the chaplaincy is a great job. If anyone out there considering doing military chaplaincy work, I would definitely recommend that.
We're going to take a short break right now. We'll be back with Rabbi Rami Shapiro. We're going to be talking about perennial wisdom, which seems to have been overridden by perennial stupidity, but we're going to talk about perennial wisdom. And I still have faith in a sense that we are moving in that direction. This is Steve Behrman. We're on Wiki Politiki.
Connecting you with the best of the conscious minds in the world. Om Times Radio, IOM FM. Om Times Magazine is one of the leading online content providers of positivity, wellness, and personal empowerment. A philanthropic organization, their net proceeds are funneled to support worldwide charity initiatives via Humanity Healing International. Through their commitment to creating community and providing conscious content, they aspire to uplift humanity on a global scale. Om Times, co-creating a more conscious lifestyle.
More than 24 million Americans have an autoimmune disorder, and that number continues to grow. I'm Sharon Saylor, and I'm one of those 24 million. To put that number in perspective, cancer affects about 9 million and heart disease up to 22 million. That's why I've brought together top experts and those thriving regardless of their diagnosis to bring you the latest, most up-to-date information. Join me, Sharon Saylor, Friday night, 7 p.m. Eastern, for the Autoimmune Hour on Life Interrupted Radio to find out how to live your life uninterrupted.
Are you done with the daily barrage of negativity? Ready for some positivity? Creations Magazine has been inspiring the soul for over 30 years, delivering thought-provoking and solution-driven articles, essays, and poetry that inspire you to enjoy a vibrant life. Holistic health, personal and spiritual growth, relationships, the environment, and so much more. Read us online or order a subscription, creationsmagazine.com.
911, what is your emergency?
My kid shot himself.
All right, where's the wounds?
911, what's your emergency?
Please help. My son shot his brother.
911, what is your emergency?
Okay. 911, please state your emergency.
Every day, 8 kids and teens are unintentionally killed or injured by loaded and unlocked guns.
It wasn't locked.
It wasn't locked.
Learn how to make your home safer at endfamilyfire.org. Brought to you by the Ad Council and End Family Fire.
Steve Behrman, we're back on WikiPolitiki with our guest, Rabbi Rami Shapiro. Rabbi, you talked about being a chaplain in the Air Force, and in recent years, there's been a lot of controversy around the Air Force in a way reinforcing and enforcing fundamentalist Christian beliefs. Are you familiar with that? Is there any insight you might have about that?
Familiar, yes. Insight, I don't know. I mean, fundamentalist Christians have been working on this, taking over in various ways, you know, trying to take over various ways, education, military, media. I mean, they're just planting their people everywhere. And it's a real challenge. That's why, you know, it's a good thing when you have interfaith ministers taking on the role of military chaplain, when you have people who are not fundamentalist in whatever denomination or religion they're in going into chaplaincy. Mm-hmm. It's very scary when the notion of onward Christian soldiers becomes a fact and not simply a slogan. So that is very nerve-wracking, but it's no more nerve-wracking than what you see in the courts and what you see in so many other aspects of our society. That's really why I push the holy rascal idea.
Let's talk about that. But first, I want to talk about the One River Foundation, because I think that that speaks to the much more ecumenical perennial wisdom. How did that come about? And talk to us a bit about the mission and how you're looking to impact the current spiritual, religious, and social conversation.
I created One River Foundation originally around 2000. Then I let it lapse and I recreated it. I resurrected it a few years ago.
So to speak, right?
The idea then and in the more recent iteration is based, I mean, the name itself, One River, is based on a song by Peter Yarrow. There's only one river, there's only one sea, it flows through you, it flows through me. And we got permission from Peter, Paul, and Mary to actually use the song, and the song is a very powerful expression of this notion of unity and even non-duality, that everything is a manifesting of this singular reality. Mm-hmm. And the mission of it is simply to promote perennial wisdom as a philosophy and for action, you know, the be a blessing, and all that stuff comes under the umbrella of One River. So I do seminars several times a year here in Tennessee. I travel elsewhere and run perennial wisdom seminars. We call them Cup of Wisdom because there's a book that I created called The World Wisdom Bible, and we go through the Bible. And the idea of the World Wisdom Bible is that it's a selection. So it's a big anthology of texts from different religions on the same set of themes. And you discover that Krishna and Christ were saying something very similar. And when you see that, hopefully what's triggered in you is that, wait a minute, maybe there's something deeper that they're both tapping into rather than something unique that one or the other is manifesting. That's the gist of what the foundation is about.
You know, obviously in your upbringing, you probably had, the values of tolerance and that sort of thing. So it was probably a relatively easy transition for you to make, you know, from your the kind of Judaism that I grew up with, which is much more, live a good life, do good things, take care of people, be open and tolerant and so on. Have you had experiences with people who have been in much more restrictive systems, opening up to that perennial wisdom idea? And in those instances, even if they're rare, what do you think the process was for people to make that transition?
So I would say, I mean, first of all, yes. I mean, I've had lots of instances with people who, we're talking about Jews now, but you could say the same thing about Christians coming from a more rigid Christian background. So, yeah. I mean, I've had experiences with people coming out of those more fundamentalist, behavioralist systems, awakening to the fact that their Judaism or their Christianity or their Islam or whatever you want to, whatever we're talking about, is simply a manifesting of this greater understanding that all the world's mystics have. So, you know, I would say at the heart of every religion, there's some mystic experience that someone had and that ultimately became organized, at which point it died. But the
yes.
remnants of it, right, the residue of that experience still resonates somewhere in the system. So, yeah, people do, when they hear it, it seems so, oh, of course, how could it be otherwise? For many, right? And equal number go, are you kidding? I mean, I'll give you an example. I was in Rome. I was called to Rome years ago to teach a group of nuns for a week in Rome about the mother goddess. I had this whole theory that Mary, Jesus's mother, was an archetype, was an expression, a Christian expression of a universal archetype, including Kali, including Shekhinah in the Hebrew tradition, including Sophia and the Chochmah in the Christian and Jewish traditions. But every religion has this feminine character. And I pitched them this idea with texts and discussions that I called it the woman of a thousand faces after Joseph Campbell's hero of a thousand faces. And I said, yeah. Look, they're all these different women are the same feminine archetype. And they were gracious. I mean, we had to work through translators. It was a stretch on their part as well as mine. They were gracious. They were welcoming. And at the end, they said, you know, this was really interesting, and you're wrong. Mary is Mary, and she's unique, and got nothing to do with Kali. So, you know, you get both responses.
You know, it's very interesting. There's a very interesting character, a photographer and traveler named Martin Gray. And Martin has spent the last 30 or 40 years visiting sacred sites all over the planet. And when he visits sites that are kind of Marian sites where people have seen Mother Mary, lo and behold, for centuries and millennia prior to Christianity, these were actual goddess sites where people had been going there to see the goddess long before there was any understanding or any name or any label on it, that these things are enduring and archetypal. And, you know, and again, even if it's hard to liberate a bunch of nuns or priests or anybody who's kind of in a system that they don't want to leave, there's younger generations, I think, who are much more willing and able to accept that universality. It's because it's such a compelling idea. If they're able to see the hypocrisy of what we have right now, it seems like it's an idea that could catch on. It's just that, you know, and you are presenting it there. You're playing a very tough crowd. In going against or actually not going against but going beyond. You're not going against religion, you're going beyond religion. And that's really what becomes scary to people who I love that spirituality is our connection with the divine and religion is crowd control. So for those people who are in that system of crowd control, it could be threatening. And I think that brings us to the holy rascal concept. Tell us more about how the holy rascal could perhaps infiltrate these kind of old beliefs and turn them inside out.
Yeah, I mean, the holy rascal is somebody who either within one of these systems or from without is, like you said, not pushing against, but leading beyond, pointing beyond the system itself. I mean, the holy part is that they're working with, they're not saying, ah, religion is bunk, let's just get rid of it. Spirituality is simply a con, let's not deal with it. They're not doing that. They're accepting the general idea that there is this spiritual evolution, that religion has value on a number of different levels, artistic and musical and, you know, cultural and communal. But the rascal part is what makes it interesting to me. So the rascal is someone who really is about disrupting big religion. You know, we have big pharma, big agro, right? So we have big religion, the crowd control religion, the religion of the strict father god, who really sets up this patriarchy and the hierarchy of power and control and all these things that make, in my mind, religion so, as it's currently practiced, whether it's Eastern or Western, so many of them are simply, I mean, the misogyny and the xenophobia are just, you know, running rampant in these systems. And the rascal is disrupting that, and usually through humor, but also by pointing out a deeper reality that people can, even if it's by accident, slip into if the rascal, the holy rascal, is clever enough in the way she presents it. So, you know, I have hope in that idea that there are spiritual disruptors. And I mean, it's not that I'm making it up. I know that they are there. I can list, you know, I can list people who are doing the disruption. But it is a tough row to hoe. And you have to be very,
here you are.
The universe is random. You know, life is so chaotic, so oftentimes random. So we have these beliefs that say, no, there's control. No, it's not my personal philosophy or theology, but I want to do that. And I have my own ways of dealing with the chaos of everyday life. So that's the boundless curiosity part. And then you have this compassion because you know it's coming from a human place, even if it comes out in an inhumane manner.
You know, I think perhaps the most radical thing we can do is listen. A number of years ago, my wife and I were buying a car, and the loan officer asked what I did for a living. I told him I did comedy, and I said, I just wrote a book called Spontaneous Evolution. And he goes, oh, no, I've taken the Lord Jesus Christ as my Lord and Savior. I don't believe in evolution. Well, the next day, we had to spend pretty much hours with this guy while we waited for the car to be delivered. And I think it's going to be a tough bunch of hours. And so I just simply started asking him about his life. And he had been a Vietnam veteran who had PTSD, became an alcoholic, was literally in the gutter. And from this moment in the gutter, he felt Jesus reaching out to him. And this hand, this helping hand, saved his life. And I listened to his story. And at the end, he was crying, and he hugged Trudy, my wife and I, and he says, I've never been in a conversation like this. And, you know, when we simply listen and we understand how people come to that and we let them hear themselves, then enough safety is created that perhaps there's more flexibility in their perspective. And he reached out to me. He says, I want to go hear Swami perform. And it was totally unlike anything he had ever said. But it came only because of that other piece that you said. The two pieces were curiosity. I was curious enough to ask him about his life. And then what he perceived as compassion, which was simply being able to listen without judgment and without imposing my views on him. He didn't have anything. There was no pushing against him. I was simply welcoming his words. And the more welcome he felt in that space, the more safe he felt, and the more closely he got to experience this universality that you and I are both looking to help people find in their lives. So that's really, you know, in these times, I know in our prior conversation, you mentioned wanting to talk about the future of religion in these times of crisis and climate change. How do you think that our religious systems are going to be challenged or are being challenged by these things that are happening out there in the world now?
That is a huge question.
In 25 words or less.
Yeah, 25 words or less. I think that most religious institutions are simply in denial, that they haven't thought ahead to say, okay, what is Judaism or Christianity or Hinduism or whatever it is in the Thunderdome? Because the climate disaster that we are moving toward is going to create, not for everybody, but for huge swaths of humanity, you know, that Thunderdome environment where it's going to be just the opposite of love your neighbor. It's all going to be about fear and scarcity and all these other things. And religion ought to be at the forefront of creating beloved communities or communities of the beloved, where you are building, you know, social networks, spiritual networks, practice networks, contemplative networks that are going to be the create islands of love and sanity as humanity experiences a real dark, dark night. And I don't see them doing that. So, you know, they're just not, when you talk, when I just was listening to some rabbis talk about the future of Judaism 40 years hence, only one of them said, well, you know, we have to take climate change into account. And then she said it, and then she went on and talked about something else, because how do you take it into account? You know, it's just, it's going to be so massive. The refugee problem is going to be so huge. The amount of destruction of not just human life, but just life is going to be so enormous. How does religion respond? And I don't think they're thinking about that. The religious leaders are thinking about it.
What a great question to end this segment on. We're going to take a little break, and we'll be back with a final segment with Rabbi Remy Shapiro and talking about perhaps the signs of the uprising here on WikiPolitiki Radio. We'll be back shortly.
Free your mind with Om Times Radio, IOM FM.
Ascending Hearts is no ordinary dating site, but a spiritual dating site with a purpose, to link you with your soulmate. We engineer the serendipity so you can trust that you will attune with someone that has the same matching vibration as you. Ascending Hearts, the conscious dating site for the spiritually aware. Try Ascending Hearts for free, ascendinghearts.com.
Hello, I'm Lisa Berry. Join me every Monday at 1 p.m. Eastern Time for Light on Living, a chance to see new, hear different, and feel more as I shine the spotlight on all the ways to lighten the load of life's challenges. Light on Living is your link to that new way you're looking for, that new understanding that will enhance your life, and that positive connection that will support your growth. So join me, and you'll gain insight and start to see things in a new way that motivates you.
The Shift Network. Presenting transformative programs and events to help you awaken to your full potential so that together we can build the more beautiful world our hearts know is possible. Our classes support you in finding and cultivating your gifts and in bringing those gifts to the world to create tangible change and connect us as global citizens. Go to theshiftnetwork.com or follow the link on the WikiPolitiki sponsors page.
Imagine being fired because of who you love. Imagine being denied medical treatment because of who you marry. Imagine being evicted because of who you are. Millions of Americans don't have to imagine this. They have to live it. Because in 31 states, it's legal to discriminate against LGBT people. Get the facts at beyondido.org. brought to you by the Gill Foundation and the Ad Council.
Steve Behrman, Wiki Politiki. We're back with our guest, Rabbi Rami Shapiro. And, you know, again, we're looking at a lot of denial out there. I think that that's one of the drugs people seem to be strung out on. We call it Denyatol, a very popular drug. Given the dark and perhaps dystopian times, what do you see as a sign of the uprising, a sign that that there is an awakening taking place, and that there's something that is moving? Do you see a sign of a glimmer of light, something stirring, something that is calling us forth?
Yeah, I think there are several signs that something is percolating. I don't think that the something is going to erase the dark night of human civilization. I think it's going to help us get through it. But a couple of things. I mean, number one, and this is an overstatement, but the emptying out of so many churches and synagogues and other, you know, patriarchal centers of religious power, people aren't going. And I think that's a good sign, because it starts to take the pulls the rug out from under the big father God paradigm. So that's one. And, you know, in the Pew study, the recent, it was a few years ago, I guess, the Pew study said that the fastest growing, in quotes, denomination of Americans, they called it the nuns, which I hate that word, N-O-N-E-S, because it's very negative. And I don't like spiritual but not religious, because some of these people are still religious. I use the word spiritually independent, people who are not allowing themselves to be completely
I like that term, by the way. Good term. Let's keep that meme flying around. Spiritually independent.
Okay.
Good. No, that's
spiritually
good. Okay, go ahead. Yeah.
So that the rise of the spiritually independent is one thing. Another thing is the return of the Divine Mother as an archetype for God, moving away from, not going strictly from patriarchy to matriarchy, from God the Father to God the Mother, but a much more holistic understanding of deity that incorporates the archetypes of masculine and feminine. But I think because of the overwhelming dominance of patriarchal imagery, we see a lot more of the Divine Mother emerging. So this is maybe a little facile, but I don't really think so. There's Our Lady of Guadalupe, but there's no Our Guy of Guadalupe, you know. That Jesus doesn't show up, maybe once in a while in a pizza slice or a piece of toast, but mostly it's Mary who makes an appearance. And I think that's becoming more and more common. And whether it's Mary or it's Kali or it's Durga or Shekhinah or, you know, whatever the system is that we're dealing with, whatever faith she takes, the Divine Mother is pushing back into the forefront of human consciousness. And with her, I mean, she's not your mom. I mean, she's this all-powerful being, the image of Kali with, you know, the necklace of skulls and the axes and, you know, all the gore. I mean, it's this mother who loves you so much that she's going to tear away everything that's absurd and evil. And that's going to, from many of our points of view, that's going to be really painful. But it's ultimately done, you know, with love. I think that we're seeing in many different ways the collapse of patriarchy. Now, patriarchy is not, I think, the notion of, you know, the evolutionary thinking that's taking hold. You know, the fact that the fellow you talked to when we were buying a car, and he heard the word evolution and he freaked. I mean, that is not his fault. That's the fault of science, the scientists who have given us a view of evolution that is just so materialistic, when in fact there's so much more to it. We can look at I guess his name just went out of my head, but the Indian saint who wrote, I don't know if you know the book, The Divine the life divine, Sri Aurobindo. There I go. It came back to me.
Ah, Sri Aurobindo.
Sri Aurobindo. Yeah, he talks about evolution, but in a very different way. And the evolution that, that this fellow was taught in his church is a straw, you know, straw man, straw woman, whatever you want to call it, but an idea that's easily disproved and knocked over. And they use it as a, as someone, something to scare you with. And that's science's fault on one hand, because they just haven't given us a fuller understanding of what evolution might be. Though there are some, like Nancy Abrams, Joel Primack, who are really great scientists and science mm-hmm. journalists, who are really giving us a much fuller picture of what this is all about. Carter Phipps in his book Evolutionaries does the same thing. So it's not everyone falling into the trap of materialism, but the people who are using science as a to fearmonger, they're taking the materialistic view. And then the scientists who have this disdain for religion and spirituality fall into a similar trap on the other side. So it's a shame that that was his response. The whole notion of Trinity could be seen as an evolutionary expression of evolution. But anyway, so there, I think there are lots of things going on, but none of it is going to save us from the dark night. I mean, it's like I'm very interested in 12-step, the ideas of 12-step, the practices of 12-step, and I apply it not simply to named addictions, but to just human existence, you know, itself. And I think 12-step is a spiritual practice in and of itself, even if you don't have an addiction to a certain substance. I mean, we're all addicted to ego. We're all addicted to control. So in the 12-step context, you got to hit rock bottom. If you don't hit rock bottom, no new breakthroughs can happen. If you want Christian metaphor, if you don't get crucified, there's no resurrection. There's no exodus if there isn't slavery. I mean, all these things. There has to be this dark night if there's going to be a breakthrough. And I don't think it's a one-time thing, both for individuals, but also for the civilization, human civilization. It's a spiral. And I think it's going mm-hmm. up. I think the spiral is going, you know, uprising, like the way you put it, but also expanding bigger in that circle of compassion. So we're getting more wise and more compassionate. The way the Buddhists put it, prajna, wisdom, and karuna, compassion, go together. So that is happening. But as the spiral turns in on each level, there is that dark night that has to happen in order for there to be, you know, first a breakdown and then a breakthrough. So even though there are signs of what the breakthrough might be, it's not going to save us from the horrors to come.
So what you're suggesting is that the purpose of this compassion and curiosity and all of these tools of blessing are really, really we're being called to be hospice workers for the old and hopefully doulas and midwives for the new, that the new spiritual, the relevant spiritual practice that you're talking about, that's on a practical level, as the quote-unquote seas are rising and all of these things are taking place. You know, it's funny. I heard this joke that I love. You know, there are all of these people saying, you know, Donald Trump was sent by God. And there are the other people who are saying, yes, because he ran out of locusts, you know. So, you know. So we have that dire situation, and you know, again, every journey has this dark night. So, given all of that, what do you do for yourself that others might copy to cultivate your own well-being? Because you're not willing, you know, you're willing to look into the heart of darkness. You're not going to be in denial of what's in front of us. You're looking at all of that. How do you keep your equanimity, and how do you continue to inspire other people?
Yeah. So first of all, let me say that I don't think you can keep your equanimity. I think I just gave a TEDx talk about what I call the way of the Weeble, Can you remember Weeble's, the little Fisher Price toy? The motto was Weeble's wobble, but they don't fall down. So I'm a wobbler, you know, but you come back to center, and that's the equanimity. But then it's shattered by the next, you know, the next event in my life. I think that the question, though, is sound. I mean, it's how do you cultivate your own well-being? Humans operate on five dimensions: body, heart, mind, soul, and spirit. And I think you need practice for each dimension. So when it comes to body, I like to walk. I do Qigong. Heart meditation for me is, you know, the Buddhist metta practice where you're sending blessings out to people, and that's part of my whole Be a Blessing program. Mm-hmm. Mind is to study these texts, to realize that there is a deeper perennial wisdom that is common to all of us. Soul are those practices that reveal the interconnectedness of things. So for me, that's meditation, mindfulness meditation, or centering prayer. I mean, there's so many different, you know, ways of practicing meditation. But we're talking about meditation that doesn't erase the sense of self. It simply places the sense of self in the larger context of the whole. And then the spirit level is a practice that does, in fact, allow the individual self to dissipate for a period of time. And that's the most difficult of all the things. First of all, you can't do that. If you set out consciously to force the ego to disappear, it's the ego that's doing the forcing, and you just can't. You can't surrender yourself. You can't crucify yourself. You can't take yourself to rock bottom. It just happens. But for me, the practice that I use for that, without knowing the paradox of even saying it, is Ramana Maharshi's, you know, who am I kind of meditation, constantly questioning the very nature of my small s self. Who's thinking this? Who's feeling this? And realizing that there is a field of awareness that isn't Rami, but that Rami, that, you know, a field of awareness that manifests me the way a ocean manifests the wave. And I can rest in that. And his practice and some others are ways of priming the pump for that to happen. So bottom line, though, I mean, that was a quick thing. That was a lot in a very short period of time. But the bottom line is, I think people need some series of practices. No one practice is sufficient that works these different dimensions to keep us as balanced as we can be, or as healthy as we can be in the continual wobbling of our everyday existence.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, the traditional ways, I mean, there's some traditional ways that can be adopted. Of course, many of the traditional ways from the East without the dogma, the Qigong, the yoga, et cetera, meditation, that puts us in touch with the soul and spirit. And I think that there's going to be, you know, in a way, there's going to have to be some kind of group collective awareness that kind of comes to consciousness, not through force, as you would say, but through realization. People, you know, many people around the world at the same time realizing the wisdom in the perennial wisdom. So we've got about a minute or two left. Is there anything you want to add to this, or anything you want to suggest to people as they embrace the world as it is?
Right. Here's the, if you need one thing to do, I would chant. You know, I mean, if you can do the body, heart, mind, soul, spirit thing, that's great. But if you need one thing to do today, I would find a mantra, some short phrase that you can repeat over and over again. Not an affirmation, not like I am beautiful and I'm healthy and I'm, I mean, that stuff, I just want to shoot myself. But, you know, a phrase that reminds me of the totality of which I am a part. And you can look these up. Eknadeshwaran's book, Make the Rivers Flow, is a collection of mantra that can be used. There's lots of one-liners in every tradition that people can adapt to their daily use. And repeat that. Have it in the back of your mind over and over and over again. So whenever you're not doing anything, which is, of course, you're always doing something, but whenever your mind is not occupied in doing something, you shift to the mantra. And I find that the repetition of a sacred phrase or a word is a powerful way to keep myself, you know, in and out of balance without, you know, wobbling, but without falling over.
Well, in the beginning was the word. And so a word to the wise is creative. Thank you. Thank you, Rabbi Rami Shapiro, the One River Foundation, the Holy Rascal. We hope to have you on again. This is Steve Behrman at Wiki Politiki, and we'll be with you again next week. Thank you again, Rabbi Rami Shapiro.
Thanks, Steve. It was a pleasure.